This is pretty much Pop, a culture podcast. We know shit from Shinola, but stroll right through the shit anyway. Today we're discussing the career of Steve Martin, from his 70s stand-up, through The Jerk, through his many films, through Only Murders in the Building, and his various other activities recently. This is Mark Lintonmeyer, and I do mind if you smoke.
This is Al Baker, also proving it's perfectly possible to build a career on likability over talent.
I'm Sarah Lynn Bruck, and I hate and will destroy all cans at all costs, no matter what.
This is Lawrence Ware coming to you from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and I am incredibly talented, but am I funny?
My intro had a deep cut in there. Do you know the joke? Hey, do you mind if I smoke?
No, not at all. Not
and the response?
All. Oh, I know it. Yeah.
Say it.
Do you mind if I fart?
There you go. So this was a key influence right after Bill Cosby as a child. And my dad, in fact, took out the naughty parts in recording some LPs onto cassette for me. But I think this smuggled its way in. So not only is it a nice fart joke, but it is a much more succinct way. You know, another comic might like, you know, when people ask you if they could smoke, I mean, that's just like just blow a noxious air. It's just, you know, so going off about how bad smoking is. So simplicity, I think there's a genius to that.
I'm happy you see the genius. I don't see it, but sounds great.
What's everybody's history with Steve Martin?
I've got a passing familiarity with him, but I've had that passing familiarity with him for a really long time. I was a child in the 90s, and I feel like I saw one or the other of the Father of the Bride movies on TV almost every weekend. It seemed like it was hard to escape. I saw the Three Amigos on opening weekend for some reason. Yeah, Steve Martin's just always kind of been there in the background, and he seems like a really interesting figure, because I think Lawrence put it a lot better than me in the intros, because I very ungenerously called him untalented, and he's certainly not untalented. Lawrence asked whether he was talented, but not really that funny, and I think that's probably a better way to phrase the question. But that's kind of the question that I'm coming at this podcast with, is like, Steve Martin, definitely successful, definitely likable,
extremely talented.
In deference to Lawrence, extremely talented. I think his banjo playing is absolutely masterful, but it's not obvious to me why he's had the exact success that he has.
Al is raising all kinds of questions that I'm not going to get into yet. All right, let's go back to what Mark said. All right, so I thought I did not have much of a relationship with Steve Martin. Looking back over his filmography and doing a deep dive, I realized I have a rather deep relationship with him. So I remember The Jerk. I remember seeing him in Three Amigos. I remember seeing him in Little Shops of Horrors. I remember seeing him in Roxanne. I really enjoyed Roxanne when I was a kid. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Parenthood, Dirty Rotten Scandals, Father of the Bride 1 and 2. I realized that I really, really had a deep relationship with this guy. I did not know that I did. And I watched Only Murders in the Building. I'm at a loss of four words because I watch him with amusement, but I very rarely laugh. And so I don't know what to do with that, because I clearly have a relationship with him. I'll tell you this, my mother has a huge relationship with Steve Martin. She watched all his stuff. And so I watched it by being around her, but I never sought him out. It was never something that I wanted. It was always something thrust upon me. The only time that I actually watched something that I wanted to watch that starred Steve Martin was Bowfinger, the movie with Eddie Murphy, which was abysmal.
Oh, yeah.
And not good at all.
We can fight about that, but go
ahead.
We
can fight about it. But looking at him, he is a good, he's a fine writer. He's fine. He's a fine writer. He's not great. He's a fine writer. A really good banjo player. Is he funny? I don't know. I mean, he scratches the itch of some people, clearly. I am with Al on this one. I don't understand the career that he's had, but I definitely see that he is remarkably talented. He's very likable. But beyond that, I don't see much there.
All right, Sarah, we are of the proper generation. Please proceed, Sarah.
Yeah, you know, and also I realized he is almost exactly the same age as my parents. They were both born in the second half of 1945. And so he was a staple in our household growing up. And I always thought he was funny, even going back and watching some of his old stand-up bits. They still resonate for me. And it may be because of that history, but I feel like Steve Martin has been performing in my life, like for my entire life, he has been. I mean, he literally has been. So I have a deep appreciation and I absolutely love him. I can't even imagine a world without his comedy. It feels like it's just been there. There's a reason why he's been around for so long. And I think it's because he is funny. Sorry, Lawrence. He is.
So I could see how people who have encountered him in the latter portions of his life, and I'm including in that The Father, The Bride, and, you know, when he was like a major bankable star, because I think all of this only makes sense, just like Dan Aykroyd, in light of like 1978. And if you weren't at all conscious, you know, some people like maybe they came, I was only seven.
Or alive.
Seven in 1978. Right. There are people that explore this retroactively and get into this. So here's a piece of the show, Freaks and Geeks, the Judd Apatow, Paul Feig, so current crop, or, you know, I guess they're still as old as me, but anyway, younger crop of comedians. One of the scenes in there, the main character has been sort of romancing this other 12-year-old girl and finally gets to go out with her, and they see the jerk, and she doesn't like it. And he's like, I have to break up with you, because if you don't get the jerk, there's something wrong with you. This is like a litmus test on whether you have comic sensibility or not. And I will stand by that. I think the jerk, I've seen many, many times. I'm sure I will see many more times. I think it is miles ahead of Blues Brothers, Animal House, Stripes, the other sort of classic Saturday Night Live related comedies of that day.
The early SNL.
Everything else is sloping off of that. But I mean, I just watched The Man with Two Brains yesterday, and it's stupid humor. But there was a lot of stuff that made me laugh. Parts of it don't age well, but I think he thinks himself that his stand-up would not necessarily be immortal, would not necessarily age well, that you sort of had to be there at the time, that it was a reaction to, well, he says, the seriousness of people bummed out by Vietnam.
Oh, yeah. Or rejecting the punchline.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys watch the documentary?
I did.
No.
We know why Lawrence at least can appreciate him, because the documentary presents him in the most sympathetic way, this two-part Apple documentary. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just thought it was really interesting, especially you guys and your philosophy backgrounds. He was kind of dismantling what stand-up was. And I think that's partly why he was so popular, is because he absolutely took apart and put it back together what a stand-up act could be. And that I found really fascinating. And I think that was born out of, unless you could disagree with me, Mark, but I think it was born out of his philosophy background from college.
Yeah, he says stuff like that. He also said that he started as a magician.
Right.
But then found that when he failed at the tricks, people liked it better. You know, when it was a fun. So making people laugh offered more overhead, he said, in terms of advancement than being a magician. So he actually did not start as like this comedy nerd. It was sort of something that he drifted into as a performer. And it took him a decade to build this stand-up act where it was consistently funny, where he was just trying basically just silly stuff. And how can I, challenge the expectations of people who are sitting and watching someone on a stage? Like maybe, so it's sort of, you know, like Andy Kaufman at the same time.
Right, right.
You know, let me get mad at the audience. Let me just stand here and do nothing. Let me maybe drop all my props on the floor. Let me, you know, just see what actually sticks.
This is interesting right off the bat, because one thing I did want to talk about is how interesting it is that Steve Martin had a reputation in his early stand-up as a kind of revolutionary act with his, you know, absurdism and whatnot. But historically, in terms of his reputation, his legacy, especially if you compare him with other SNL luminaries of the time, especially John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd.
Someone who died, yes.
He's got a tamer, kind of more mainstream. He's gone on a more tame and mainstream direction. Or at least for me and my generation, he's the Father of the Bride guy.
Yes.
John Belushi is the Maverick of comedy guy. And hearing you talk about his experiences as a frustrated magician, maybe he's just uncannily good at developing a product for the market, right? He saw an opportunity to fill a hole in the entertainment industry and kind of went for it. Maybe there's a similar kind of savviness at play in him becoming, again, I don't know if this is exactly true, but it feels like he was, if not the first, at least one of the first people to make the transition from like SNL type stalwart to romantic comedy movie star. That's a novel path to take, or at least it was for him.
One of the things that I was taken with was I really enjoyed watching him on SNL for some reason. I found him to be a really good SNL star. I thought he was quite good on that. when he started doing movies, I'm really trying not to be a downer, but it's like he was doing things that seemed funny, but maybe it didn't hit me. I don't know what it is. Like, for example, when you go to The Jerk, for example, it's stuff that should be funny, but for whatever reason just didn't hit me. Like, what am I missing? Because I feel like you and Sarah have this deep appreciation for him. So, for example, I watched the documentary. I really enjoyed it. I really found him fascinating. I really enjoyed watching that. Al, I would strongly, strongly encourage you to watch that documentary because I think it does a wonderful job, both as the documentary director and whatnot, but also the subject matter. It's really, really good. Very interesting. I find him to be a very interesting character, but he doesn't hit for me. And I don't know why, because usually I'm an easy mark for comedians. It's easy to make me laugh. It is not hard. I laugh at the dumbest Instagram videos that I come across. I'm an easy mark. But for some reason, it just didn't hit. So is this a generational thing? Is it a racial thing? Like, what's going on? What am I missing that you guys clearly are able to tap into?
I think it could be either of those things. I take that back, actually, because he has absolutely changed his career. You know, his first obsession was obviously with stand-up. He gave that up in 1980. He switched over to movies and he became a huge movie star. And I do feel like he is most interested in not necessarily in meeting the market, but I think he's a guy who probably gets really bored with whatever it is that he's doing, you know, and he gets to the top of one mountain and he's like, all right, on to the next one.
I also watched in preparation for this, just looking up on YouTube, because you can see, you know, parts of his stand-up on there. Somebody put together all of his appearances on Letterman. So there's like four different two-hour files. So I watched, you know, a good chunk of a couple of them.
You're a big fan.
Well, this was just, you know, if it's the podcast thing. If you're going to do something, why not do it at this moment when we're actually preparing for something?
Sure.
You
know? Sure.
Fill the time. But I would not normally look for that. And, you know, I think he's known for being especially good in that sort of situation.
He was good. You're right about that.
So like one of them, he and Letterman are talking about how meticulous they are about their preparation. And they're like, oh, well, let's show some video from, you know, last week when we were preparing for this appearance. And it's just completely absurdist, this debating of, oh, and then I'm going to pick up the coffee cup like this. And they're fighting over the coffee cup. And there was another one that was, you know, doesn't age well necessarily, but was a Steve and Dave's gay vacation or something, as if like right after they are on the show together, they went off on spring break and are frolicking on the beach and things. And just these conceptual things that I think that this is where it comes through. It definitely becomes more gentle and subtle over the years. And it seemed like his last, with Roxanne and LA Story, which I was not able to rewatch, but I remember that being a high point. He had these sort of personal films that were more romantic, that was like, this is my serious thing. Since then, it doesn't seem like it seems like he just does that in his writing, in his novels. Whereas, you know, he's just happy to show up in something that seems to have competent people behind it. He was a co-writer on the premiere for Only Murders, but none of the rest of it. And yeah, so we should eventually talk about what is immediately, you know, this is the thing that he's in now that he has said, I'm not going to seek any more roles on screen after this. Like, this is, you know, maybe he will, but he's not going to seek it out.
He certainly doesn't need to.
He could have stopped many years ago.
So Only Murders is his swan song.
It appears to be.
As far as this goes, I mean, but it's a different thing when you're like writing a play and you write every word of it yourself. Like, I think he's still doing stuff like that, or writing his songs and things.
You know, one of the things that I find fascinating about him is just how incredibly talented he is. Again, he's not my speed when it comes to stand-up comedy, but I was really taken. I read like three of his books. Well, two books, one novella. I read Shop Girl. It seemed like he takes it seriously.
Which were the ones you read?
I read Shop Girl, I read An Object of Beauty, and I read Late for School, which is a children's book. I read those three things, and it seems like he's taking that very seriously. He's actually trying when it comes to that. And then his music, he is very talented in that. He's actually working. He's trying when it comes to that. So what we have is a person who is just incredibly talented. And I'm willing to admit that maybe his comedy just doesn't hit me. And it's fine that it doesn't hit me. But his comedy just is not my speed. But I deeply, deeply appreciate the ability of him to kind of sink into his work and work really hard at being a good actor and work really hard at being the best writer he can be and work really hard at being the best banjo player that he can be. And then I came across a video of him tap dancing with Gregory Hines. And he was incredible in this tap dancing. Like, he is an incredibly talented man. So I walk away from this exercise really appreciating him. I'm still on Al's corner where it doesn't work for me. It's not my kind of thing, but I really, really appreciate him. I understand now his appeal. I get it. I'm just never going to, like, outside of Only Murderers in the Building, which I kind of watch more for Martin Short than I do for him, I'm just never going to kind of return back to him. But I really appreciate him. And I'm happy that I did this, even though I will never look at his work ever again.
Let me ask one more thing of everybody, which is, so he's doing a stand-up tour with Martin Short now. So it's like his first actual comedy tour, but I'm only going to do as a duo, which I actually tried to get tickets with my dad for. It was coming through Madison, like,
that would have been wonderful.
This month.
Yeah.
And, I was poised right when the tickets were released and they were all pre-sold. This is just the situation now, at least with some, like, I don't know, you have to be on some list for the artist or for the venue to be offered pre-sales, because otherwise it would have been $1,000 a ticket or something. If I, there were,
seriously.
Wow.
Yes.
It's like 1979 all over again.
But I did watch the Netflix special that was from like 6 years ago. So maybe this is like why they're doing this now.
I saw that.
And I thought it was great. Al, what did you think of that?
I thought parts of it were very good, but I thought large swathes of it were at times achingly unfunny. I intended my next piece to be saying something very, very nice about Steve Martin, but I'll come back to that later.
Achingly unfunny.
Like the trading insults part, right? That sort of started things off.
The trading insults part was charming.
That's what I'm thinking, have in mind, clearly.
Like, and just having the two, and he got the Steep Canyon Rangers out and did a couple of songs, and that was great. This is what I wanted, was charming anecdotes and back and forth and a bit of banjo playing. And all of that was brilliant. Martin Short's comedy musical number about being the stepbrother of Jesus was not funny.
I was trying to leave that out of our consideration. This is not a Martin Short podcast.
The what felt like 10-minute long skit where Martin Short was a ventriloquist dummy being puppeteered by Steve Martin was also not very funny. The material just wasn't strong. You know, maybe they've got new material for the new show, but I certainly wouldn't have been queuing around the block to get the latest round of these tickets. But here's the thing, it's that he's lovable, and Martin Short is also lovable, and it was worth the price of admission, the price of admission being my attention for the 90 minutes, to just see Martin Short and Steve Martin be friends on stage for a bit and do that kind of hokey showbiz thing.
So sort of like when I told you guys, I think this was an after talk, that I saw John Cleese live recently, which he was basically just answering questions and looking at clips of Monty Python. And this was a level higher than that, at least. But it was still like, you like these guys, right? Here they are.
Yeah.
In a case like that, though, I'd rather, if they're not going to actually write something worth seeing, I'd rather they just took questions from the audience, though, or like, or it was mostly Steve Martin playing banjo. I want to say the nice thing, which is just, I can't even count how many threats Steve Martin is. He's way past a triple threat, right? He can sing, he can dance, he can act, he can write, he can direct. He is, again, a stellar banjo player, even professional banjo player standards.
He really is.
And a terrific songwriter as well. And he's a magician. And he talks about himself as a failed magician, but he was a professional magician at the early part of his career. How many people who do magic even get to do that? What's that, 6, 7 showbiz talents? Can he make balloon animals? He's got a sketch about making balloon animals.
Juggling balloon animals, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he can juggle tangerines.
I guess let me say the mean thing then, which is, like many of these funny people, when they make the jump and try to dramatically act, I don't quite buy it. And there's a number of things where he's like the narrator. Like I just watched a Novocaine today, just not that this is one that he wrote, but it was just a film that actually I thought I hadn't seen. But then right at the end of like, I have seen this, haven't I? This is either ripped off of several other things or I have actually seen this. It's from like 2001, maybe, a noir. If he's just trying to read something in a neutral voice, I just hear it as it's the Steve Martin voice. You know, like, I think Bill Murray has a similar problem. Like, maybe they can play really mopey and down characters and do it dramatically like that, but it's a pretty narrow range. You're not going to see him in Platoon.
That would be disastrous.
I would watch it.
I would not. I don't want to watch Platoon on a good day. I'm not going to watch it with him in it.
I feel like Saving Private Ryan had a few comic actors in dramatic roles.
It did. I remember. Yeah, it did.
And I just think about this Louis C.K. sketch from his show where he's cast. It's Matthew Broderick is the director in this. And he just has to say, he's like playing a cop and has to say, I'm sorry, he's dead. And he just can't say it in a way that doesn't sound like he's trying to be funny. So, and that was a very self-aware thing for Louis C.K. to do, but Steve Martin just does those roles.
I think Steve Martin is very, very talented, but it doesn't mean he can do everything, you know? So I think that because he is so talented and he is so accomplished in so many different arenas, I understand him wanting to try to take his hand at dramatic acting. He just doesn't do it very well. You know, I will say that he is a good actor. Like, when I watch it, it never comes off as, like, he's not acting well. Like if you remember, there were, like, early Dave Chappelle roles where Dave Chappelle was trying to act. And even though it was a comedy, it wasn't good acting, even for a comedic movie. Like, he doesn't come off like that. He's a good actor. He's a solid actor when it comes to the comedic films. I just think that if I were him, I would stick to the either comedies or comedy-adjacent films, romantic comedies, things like that, Father of the Bride, those kind of things. But when he kind of goes into serious films, I just don't take him seriously. Like, his voice, his mannerisms, I just don't buy it. Like, you know, just like you, I don't buy it at all. And I think he's learned that lesson, honestly. His writing tends to be a little bit more serious, but I don't think he's trying to act serious in serious films, not really anymore.
I'm just looking at his filmography, and it's interesting because he did all of the stand-up, huge success, quit it because it was just too taxing. You know, I mean, he was traveling constantly, and it sounds horrible if you want to have a life. And then he did The Jerk, which was a huge success, right? And then right after that, he did Pennies from Heaven, which is, I don't know if anybody saw that, but it's a musical. And that's where he learned how to tap dance, Lawrence.
Okay.
He spent like 6 months or something practicing every day and learning how to dance. All of the singing was dubbed, so I don't think that he actually sang on that movie, and it wasn't received very well. You can already see, and that came out in 1981. He just wanted to try something different, and then he went right back into working with Carl Reiner again with Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, The Man with Two Brains, and then The Lonely Guy. And those three, I think, did pretty well. And then you've got all of his 80s hits.
All of Me, Career Height. All of Me, one of my favorite movies.
All of Me was such a good movie, you know, and you just go right down the line there. Three Amigos, Little Shop of Horrors, Roxanne, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Like, come on, you know. Parenthood, great. My Blue Heaven, not so great. L.A. Story, I liked L.A. Story. And then, of course, Father of the Bride series was a huge success. You know, so he has this huge streak, you know, for 10 years, 10 solid years, where he's got way more hits than misses. And most of them are, you're right, you know, they're comedies. But he has, you know, some money in the bank, and he's willing to give drama a try. And that's why you see him in the 90s kind of all over the place doing drama here, doing a supporting role there, being the straight guy here. It's really interesting, the choices that he's made.
Yeah, even from the start there. So Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid was another that, even though Carl Reiner is directing, it uses a lot of noir footage from previous movies.
Yeah, it does.
I think there's only a few characters that are new actors, and everything else is he's in. And I, not having that reference when I was a kid, and I didn't rewatch it now, I found that pretty boring. I did not like that movie very much. Yeah, and Pennies from Heaven was another tribute to his influences and just things that he enjoyed while growing up. There's definitely a lot of throwing shit at the wall to see what sticks. But I think after a while, after a certain point, it was like, yeah, I've kind of done all this. Let me just be the bankable movie star, house sitter, I see.
I saw that in the theater.
Mixed Nuts, a notoriously terrible, terrible movie. Sergeant Bilko, yeah. Notoriously bad.
Yeah, I didn't love that.
These are scattered in with his well-regarded things.
And Grand Canyon. Did you guys see Grand Canyon?
I watched Grand Canyon. I've seen that movie multiple times. I think that Grand Canyon is a wonderful movie directed by Lawrence Kasdan. I did not love Steve Martin in that movie at all.
Right. I'm with you on that. I did not think that he was great.
Maybe that's what I had in mind as not like too dramatic. Don't be in there.
It was a good movie and he was not good in it.
Kevin Kline can do that.
Yeah, he can.
Like he is really funny, but he can do a serious role. Even Robin Williams, like he's unhinged enough that
Robin Williams is amazing.
He can get out of his own skin. Whereas Eddie Murphy or Steve Martin, like they can't get out of their skin.
Okay, don't go there. No, okay, wait, time out. Don't say Eddie Murphy. Because I just watched Dreamgirls the other day. He is amazing in, and we're talking about Eddie Murphy, guys. He is amazing in Dreamgirls. What was that movie that he made about Dolomite? He was amazing in that.
I didn't see the Dolomite, so I shouldn't judge.
Oh, Dolomite Is My Name is incredible. And this is super interesting, especially you bring the Robin Williams comparison. So Robin Williams, Steve Martin, Eddie Murphy are a really, really good comparative trifecta, I think. Because Robin Williams came up around the same time as Steve Martin, but not through the same comedic route, right? But was also and maybe much more genuinely anarchic, right? You feel like Steve Martin was absurdist and anarchic as an artistic choice. Robin Williams could never have been anything else. and if you look at how their careers developed, like Robin Williams turned into, as did Jim Carrey, turned into really intensely brilliant dramatic actors. Like both of them have turned in some of my favorite dramatic movie performances of all time. And Steve Martin is just not the same kind of creature, but also neither of them have gone on to the overwhelming degree of mainstream success. I mean, both of them had their moments of being like some of the highest paid actors in Hollywood, but it really feels like Steve Martin defined a whole genre of sentimental romantic comedy early 90s cinema.
Do you think it's because if Steve Martin is sort of considered someone who's changed what stand-up is, you have somebody like Robin Williams or Eddie Murphy or Jim Carrey who are coming up sort of in the same time. It seems like if you're the one who is defining what comedy means now, it's harder to get away from that. It's harder to get away from your own shtick because all four of those comedians had a shtick that they needed to escape from. You know what I mean?
As if Steve Martin was like less identified with the shtick than the others, maybe, or...
Or maybe he was more identified with it and had to make the move to finally be able to define who he was, like, on screen.
What was Eddie Murphy's shtick? Because I don't associate him with having any kind of shtick or anything like that.
Well, maybe this is, again, that you weren't alive watching movies when he had his golden SNL period with 48 Hours and Beverly Hills Cop.
Trading Places.
The Golden Child. This character that he played again and again. Mm-hmm. So we should bring in Bowfinger here because he kind of reprised it. By then, he had gotten kind of complacent. You know, his movies weren't doing as well. But for both him and Steve Martin, this 90s movie was sort of return to form. That is just as silly. You know, Steve Martin wrote it and it's just as silly as one of his earlier scripts. And then Eddie Murphy's performances in that he does sort of this exaggerated version of himself as like an asshole celebrity, but then also his twin geek brother that I just love the voice that he does for this. I don't know. I just rewatched that a couple days ago. Scenes like where, for people that haven't seen it, it's Steve Martin character is making a movie. He's supposed to trying to get a big Hollywood star in it, played by Eddie Murphy, who of course won't even talk to him. So he decides to just shoot him without him knowing it. So they sort of chase him around parking lots and then get his twin brother, even though they don't know it's his twin brother, to do some of the back shots and things. And there's one very irresponsible seeming scene now to me where they have him cross the brother, run across a freeway and have to shoot, which just made me just about shit myself. It was so funny.
Yeah.
That scene is terrific because it's incredibly funny watching Eddie Murphy run across a freeway and then the punchline of the scene is Steve Martin saying, "That's great. We've just got to do it a couple more times."
But it's not a good movie, though. Like, it has good moments, but it's not a good movie, though. It just didn't work for me. And I love Eddie Murphy. And so I wanted to like that. It's just something about that comedy. Because Eddie Murphy clearly reveres Steve Martin. Like, he loves that guy. Dave Chappelle reveres him. You know, Chris Rock. So he's clearly operating and doing something that comedians respond to. Because it's something about him that they love. They gravitate to that guy. It just doesn't work for me. And I don't know why.
You just hate comedy, Lawrence.
Don't you dare.
You hate to laugh.
Don't you dare.
If we're going to talk about not laughing very often, let's finally move to Only Murders in the Building, which...
Oh, you guys.
I laugh quite a bit at that, actually.
I'll tell you, I'm stalled in the middle. Like, I've abandoned the show so many times. It's one of the shows that I watch with my wife. And actually, she's been the one. Even in going up to this, we finally watched one more episode from season 4 last night. But we're about halfway through, and it's just, like, has been low on our list. I admire some of the ideas, but just actually sitting through the 45 minutes or whatever of it, I just don't find that pleasing. At almost some of the scenes have been better than others. Some of the elements have been really great. His fake musical that he wrote the song for, I thought was conceptually awesome. But I know he's not one of the writers. It's not his, but he clearly, like, you know, approves of the whole thing, thinks this is a good swan song for him. So I'm going to blame him for it.
He's credited as a creator, I think, on the show, but I don't know. Yeah, mm-hmm. I don't know what exactly he did with it. It is a weird one because it's incredibly comforting. I love the show. I've seen it all, first couple of seasons, I've seen a couple of times. Mm. But it is really easy to put down again and, like, pick up later. And for a mystery with quite a thick plot, they don't make it easy to follow and they don't make it particularly consequential when you kind of forget what's going on. Feels like it simultaneously makes it hard to follow and insist that the plot is a central and important part of the show. But also, if you forget what's going on, it really doesn't punish your viewing experience that much because the pleasure mainly comes from watching Martin Short, Selena Gomez, and Steve Martin just pal around together, and occasionally Richard Kind shows up or Paul Rudd.
That's a good example that he showed up in the recent season, that his character had died in the previous season. He showed in the recent season doing this ridiculous accent, being a stuntman, and I just, like, wanted him to go away. I'm just like, you're abusing yourself and no one else. I did not like this element.
But it has Meryl Streep as well. I mean, clearly a lot of people enjoy working on this show. It's very popular. Honestly, the first two seasons I really enjoyed, but then it starts stretching the credulity of what is trying to do. And so it kind of lost me third season, fourth season. But I mean, this guy is doing credit card commercials off this. Like, he's back, man. He's out there. He's making money off this. So it's clearly very popular. I wish they would end it with the next season, because I think that it's run its course. I think it's about ready to die. But for what it was, I really enjoyed it. And then it started overstaying its welcome. But I thought it was very funny those first two seasons. I really enjoyed it. My kids love that show. Love it.
I think I like the show the most out of the four of us. I've enjoyed all of the seasons. We keep coming back. It is a show that I do understand being able to drop off and come back, but that doesn't really bother me. And if I'm forgetting some of the plot points, that also doesn't really seem like a big point of the show. I think it is exactly what you guys have all said. This is the fun to watch these three main characters bounce off of each other. That's why we're there. And it does seem like it's more Martin Short's show. Like, he's sort of the funny one. Yeah. And it does feel like Steve Martin is stepping back as more of the straight man. But still, it's very comforting, very enjoyable for me. I'll watch it for as long as it's on.
Can we compare? Did you guys watch Bad Monkey? This just came out on Apple TV.
No, I did not.
Oh, yes, I did.
It's based on those books, though. Yeah, I know the books, but yeah.
So it's a mystery show. Well, sort of a mystery, but I mean, like a... It's not quite the same thing, but it seems like it to have a similar blend of comedy and action. And I just think it's objectively a far superior show. Like, it is so sharp. I just really like that.
Seriously?
Really?
Yes. Whereas this is just, it's maybe it's too aimed at people who are 70. Only Murders.
Mark, I'm not 70. However, Vince Vaughn is excellent in Bad Monkey, but he is being Vince Vaughn. Like, that he is going right back to his old shtick, whereas Steve Martin doesn't do that. He refuses to do that. I find that in and of itself a good move. He's in his late 70s now, and he is still trying new shit. That's admirable. I love Bad Monkey. Nothing against Vince Vaughn being Vince Vaughn. And he's really perfect being Vince Vaughn in this role. But at the same time, he's going back. Let's go swing dancing, Vince.
Sarah, I feel like you're shitting on Vince Vaughn a little bit. I mean, Vince Vaughn has tried to do different things, you know.
He has, but he's not doing it in this great show. He's going back to his old thing.
Well, I think Mark would disagree with you about being a great show. But honestly, that Bad Monkey, if I remember correctly, it didn't get very good reviews from the critics, if I'm remembering correctly.
It didn't.
I don't know. But like, it's on my queue. I just never actually watched it. I never got into it. I never got a chance to watch it. But Mark, you're telling me I should watch.
93% Rotten Tomatoes, dude.
That's wonderful.
You're fucking
that's
wrong.
That's wonderful. I'm very wrong.
80%.
Why are you attacking me? I'm
meter.
Fucking wrong? God damn. You're attacking me. I feel attacked.
You as the respectable critic.
7.4 on IMDb. I think it got kind of mixed reviews.
Anyway, the point was merely to say, I think there's a pacing issue in all comedies. And the more wacky the comedy... You know, when I watch a Monty Python movie, it's really hard for me to get all the way to the end without just kind of being tired and wanting it to and there's a similar thing that some of them, like The Life of Brian or The Jerk, stick the landing. Like, they get out of there quickly enough. But even The Man with Two Brains was sort of overstaying its welcome a little bit. It tried to have, like, oh, we got to have some action. We got to have, like, a chase scene, you know, things in the end. To have something to not just make it be an hour and a half straight of comedy that you sort of just like want to be done. Whereas, you know, Holy Grail notoriously literally just ends. You know, it's just the series of jokes. This is not a Monty Python podcast, but are we running into similar things? I was trying to think that there's something similar in the way that comedy fits into Only Murders has to be something different. It's hanging out with these characters. You know, we're going to take our good, sweet time with the plot. We're not just going to write. I mean, that's the thing plot-wise. These mysteries should be 5 episodes tops. There's just not enough to them.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
If that was the point. But it's not a point. It's comedy pacing. So it has to have some other rules. So how do you guys feel about, like, the pacing on the show? Do you get bored? Seems like you guys do not get bored while you're watching it.
The pacing for each episode kind of works. And there is, even though the plot of the stakes for each episode aren't always terribly clear, getting through an episode isn't a chore. Where the pacing becomes an issue, I think, is over the course of a series. Mm-hmm. And it feels like often there's not quite enough at stake to sustain, like, an episode-to-episode murder mystery thing. But where comedy fits in, I think, is really interesting, because some of the funniest stuff I think in the show are the kind of conceptual jokes lying in the background, like Martin Short's constant efforts to revive his career, or that, like, his status as a pathetic washed up entertainer has been, and Steve Martin's character too. I'm thinking especially of the musical, like, he's got just the very idea that this play was a flop and he's going to revive it as a musical and get it together in this implausibly short amount of time. It's a very, like, Mel Brooksian plot. And it works tremendously well. And it all comes with this great denouement. The denouement of that series isn't catching the murderer. It's Steve Martin successfully singing Which of the Pickwick Triplets Did It, which was a brilliant moment of TV. And that song has been stuck in my head for, I think, a year at this point.
And Matthew Broderick's cameo in that show, where he came on and played this insufferable version of himself, that was a high point.
Yeah.
Well, didn't he play the same insufferable version of himself in Curb Your Enthusiasm?
Yeah, I think he did.
Oh. Pretty much. It was...
Yeah, he did. I don't mind the pacing of the show. I think the pacing of the show is... I'm lying. The more I think about this, you're right. About 5 episodes in, I start feeling like it's dragging its feet a little bit. So maybe you're right. Maybe it would be better, because on an episode-to-episode level, like, the episodes are solid. There's arc to them, beginning, middle, end, intrigue, all that kind of stuff. But then when you look at the course of the season, you begin to start seeing them dragging their feet a little bit and including things that maybe should not be included. So I think you're right, Mark. You know, a shorter season, you know, something along the lines of, like, what British television does, like, you know, 5 episodes, 6 episodes max, I would be good with that. I think that would be a good one. But it's just that it's playing in American television kind of expectations. And so the show kind of drags out a little bit. But yeah, at first I was going to disagree with you. But the more I thought about it, I think you might be right, Mark.
I disagree. I think that the pacing is fine. It's a show that comes out week to week. And so that for me, I mean, each show itself, you guys are right. Each show itself, great. It has a nice little arc. And I think because it comes out every week, we're not binging this, or I'm not binging it, it doesn't drag for me. I still love it. And I still think there should be the amount of episodes that they have.
The episodes are short, right?
30. That's about 30 minutes, yeah. If I remember correctly. Yeah.
Yeah, they're short.
Yeah.
So that's a plus. That they're more, they're 30 minute, that it's, and it has, it's filling a sitcom.
You guys are such haters.
God. But I will say, Sarah, that I think you're making a good point, because what I do when it comes to that show, I wait for all of the episodes to run and then I binge it. And so maybe that I am messing myself up by not waiting for it. But if I'm being completely honest with you, if I was watching that week to week, I would fall off of it. It just does not capture my attention enough to watch that week to week. It just doesn't work for me on that kind of level. So I don't know. It's a catch 22, I guess. I feel like I'm a hater this week. Like, I feel like I'm being really mean this week. And I'm not trying to be mean, because the guy is very talented. I like some of his stuff. I'm going to be more positive. You know, I think that the production design on Only Murders in the Building is quite good. I think that the acting is quite good. I think the writing is okay. I'm going to be positive moving forward. Sarah makes me feel bad.
Good.
It features a terrific performance in the early season from Tina Fey.
It really does, yes.
The parody of...
Sarah Koenig? Koenig? Yeah, I know you're talking about. The serial.
Koenig, yeah.
The serial person. The parody of that person that we didn't know we needed.
That's a podcast we should do, is talking about her. She is incredible in a lot of stuff. I'm really impressed with her.
I love Tina Fey. I would absolutely love to talk about Tina Fey. But what about, actually, I was wondering what you guys thought of the show as it presents podcasting in general. Like, I think it is kind of funny that they're following people around recording on a cell phone.
It's silly, because we would never do, yeah.
Like, just the fact that you could have people off mic that are in the room with them. I don't know. I see this whenever podcasting is depicted. It does not take seriously.
I agree.
You have to like actually have a mic in front of your face, and you can't just the basic things. And like, when do they do the editing? What, like, I just don't see the.
It would not be very cinematic to watch editing in a movie format.
No,
go ahead.
No,
it's not realistic about that, but what one thing that the show is weirdly realistic about is it feels the need always, and in my view correctly, to make excuses for how any one of the characters can afford to live in the building and in the part of Manhattan where the show takes place, which I think is great. So many shows are set in New York and everybody effortlessly gets by and somehow manages to pay for two-bedroom apartments all to themselves right opposite Central Park. But this show has entire subplots about how the hell anyone could manage to live in that building.
Yeah, I did appreciate that too.
I think that's quite smart. I think that it's kind of a commentary on things like Friends and whatnot, where these people are like dead broke, but they're living in extravagant apartments in New York City and wearing designer clothing. Man, they'd be on the streets smoking rocks.
There are in-show explanations for these things. Rent control, and there's whole episodes that are about, I think, similarly, yes, that if you have a show and you reflect on it at all, then hopefully these things get addressed at some point. I'm a little annoyed in general at true crime as a podcast format, because it is so, just out of jealousy, and because it is such a huge thing, and it's now what people think podcasts are, you know, whereas that's just one small portion of it, you know, and as well as not showing editing, like the production that goes into an NPR style podcast of any sort is very time consuming and not something that somebody can just do. Like, you, the listener, if you start a podcast tomorrow, it's not going to shoot straight to the top. I can just guarantee. And so no matter even what it's about. So it's funny that I found it implausible that this podcast has been so successful that they're in, that they're making this movie about it with all these big stars playing that. The irony is, of course, that the actual actors playing these characters are way more famous, or at least as famous as, you know, Zach Galifianakis and Eugene Levy, the people that are supposedly playing them. But as I guess I'm sucked in enough, I believe enough in the world that I don't believe that these people are playing them, that this podcast could have moved them into with that level of success.
there's a lot to be annoyed about in the genre of true crime podcasting, but one of the things that I think the show does well is satirizing the plucky amateur nature of so much like amateur true crime podcasting. And one thing I think is a real problem with, like, this is my, one of my killjoy takes, that a real problem with true crime podcasting and how it's kind of blown up as a genre is that there's now, like, for any given tragic, horrible murder story, there are always going to be a couple of dozen, like, plucky amateurs wasting police time who are trying to solve the murder by calling in, like, stupid theories and harassing the victims' families and so on. I really like in the show the way they developed a relationship between the police department and the Only Murders team, and especially how the show just pretty much routinely paints the Only Murders team as mostly getting in the way of proper police work.
I don't know if any of you have watched the other based on a true story. Is it a Peacock series? It was Kelly Cuoco, Chris Messina, also about them making a true crime podcast because they are friends with like a serial killer.
Wow.
I think it's much more straightforward in like, oh, let's go to a conference where there are, you know, all these true crime podcasts and talk about how slimy the whole business is and how it is playing on people's misery. And, you know, this is something that is brought up repeatedly in Only Murders, but I don't know. I think Only Murders is a better show than that other one, but there are things to reflect on in the genre. Let's say that.
There was a long stretch where it seemed like he's always been very cerebral. Like even his quote unquote stupid comedy, I think was still very cerebral. And then he got into art and music, and it seemed like he definitely started to, at least from the outside, it seemed like he was kind of taking himself pretty seriously. And it seems like he's softened a little bit over the last like 5 or so years, maybe 10 years. He's softened. And I wonder if it's because he had a kid, you know, pretty late in life, or maybe it's just that he's now of the age where he's like, yeah, like, who cares? You know, like, I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to make people laugh if I want. Only Murders, I think, really works because it is so inclusive. Everyone is in on the joke. He's not excluding anyone.
No, I think that's a very smart take. And I guess it feels like we're wrapping up. I mean, I maintain that Steve Martin is an admirable person. I really admire his talent. I admire his longevity. You know, there are many people who would not have lasted as long. I think that it is really remarkable that he's able to change course so many times and be a stand-up comedian and then be a actor, a comedic actor. Then he tries dramatic acting, doesn't work as well. He does a pivot. He starts writing more. I think that's very admirable. I respect that you, Sarah, and you, Mark, really find him funny. It just doesn't land for me, but I respect him. I admire him. And that Apple documentary, you listeners, I would strongly, even if you don't like this guy,
so good.
I would strongly advise you to watch that Apple documentary because you will walk away with a deeper appreciation for his art, for what he did, for what makes him so special. Because when you guys, as my podcast co-hosts, you know, were really gung-ho on talking about Steve Martin, I was like, eh, I might outsource this one. I might, you know, get you guys get a guest host or something like that. But I'm very happy that I dug in because he's very interesting. He's very talented. I really like that. He just doesn't scratch my itch. But that's okay. That's okay.
All right. We should talk about Eddie Murphy a little more in the after talk as a point of comparison because it's too much of a box to open to get into it right now. But I basically, when you have all the money in the world, when you have all the fame, what do you do?
Yeah.
And just what Sarah was describing. Yes, it sort of is a vanity project or whatever. But if you're good enough at it, then it's not a vanity project. If you have something to share, you know, so I don't know, right? Is he a literary author? Is he James Joyce? No.
No, he's
but
not.
He does the job. It is serviceable. I'm really enjoying a novella I'm going to recommend to people, The Pleasure of My Company. I'm only halfway through it.
Yeah, I read that too. I didn't enjoy that.
Yeah, that is about a guy who has a obsessive compulsive disorder. And he starts off the whole book of like, I wrote to Mensa and I was going to join them, but they got my IQ wrong and they put it as 90 instead of 190. They left out the one. And so you're from the very beginning, like, is this character like the jerk? Is he basically an idiot who has these, or is he actually a genius? And maybe it settles at some point, but it's really not clear. I just thought, you know, it's his funniest piece of fiction that I have read. Whereas Shop Girl, there's things that bug me about that. Just anything with young women dating really old guys is
gross. Did you guys see it? Did you watch it?
No, I never watched it.
I didn't rewatch it, but I watched it at the time. Yeah, what?
I watched it yesterday. And I have regrets.
Right, it's a little gross.
It was icky. No. Claire Danes, what the hell are you doing?
I didn't watch it, but the book didn't come off like that. But maybe the way they took the movie, yeah.
Yeah, I did not need that visual. Mm.
If I were a several-time divorced older man who had the charisma and power to attract a 20-something-year-old, I can't even put myself in those shoes. I'm just merely grossed out from the outside. And that is kind of like even his actual marriage, that, you know, why he has a child at this advanced age is because he found somebody super young. You know, it's in the documentary. It seems fine. It's not Sun Yi. It's not...
Oh, man.
It's all the legal up and up. There's nothing to cancel him about, but...
It's not Sun Yi. Oh, wow. Wow. I'm very happy that it's not that kind of situation.
Yeah. If I had all this money and then how would I create a band for myself? Anything that I write will be published. What would I choose to write? I think this is a fun game to play with yourself. And he has done admirably in that area, has used all this money from the movies that he didn't write, these giant, giant, big budget movies that he, I'm sure, made a ton off of. So the fact that you don't just go home and lie around all day and eat dinosaur eggs or whatever, like, is primo.
Good job.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for participating.
Thank you, guys. See you soon.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, guys.
Pretty Much Pop is part of the Partially Examined Life podcast network. Get more Pretty Much Pop at prettymuchpop.com. Get bonus content for every episode at patreon.com/prettymuchpop.